So if I
Very
hear, and this is literally the trigger
interesting.
case, right? And I hear the song,
Yeah.
and I'm sorry,
Are you there?
she's online. Okay.
Okay, good afternoon. I'm going to call the meeting of the DC Bar Board of Governors to order for Tuesday, December 12th, 2023. We have some special guests with us this afternoon, and we're going to adjust our agenda so that we can have them to speak to us. So we have Tracy Nuttall, Executive Director.
Yes.
Yes. And the DC Judicial Nomination Commission, and Marie Johns, who's our chair, I think, of the commission. And so we have a number of reports, this afternoon. So we thought we'd just wouldn't waste you all's time and just have you could just start off, as I know you just got here, so hope you're settled in. Tracy, would you like to start?
Sure. First, we'll apologize for being a little bit late. We thought you all were going to take care of your business first, and then we were going to come in afterwards. But we're here, and
Sure.
we're prepared to walk you through our process. I have been with the JNC for a little over 3 years. Prior to joining the JNC, many of you may have seen me or worked with me when I was at the courts, the DC Court of Appeals, for a number of years. And I have the pleasure of having our chair, Marie Johns, with me, and she can introduce herself
Sure.
as she, in her own fashion.
Thank you, Tracy. And again, my apologies as well.
No
We thought we were
worries.
following instructions,
No,
but
no,
hopefully you had time to fellowship and eat some yummy food, it looks like.
no.
But thank you for the invitation to appear before you today and talk a little bit about the Judicial Nomination Commission. We've been busy, and that's a good thing. And we are grateful for the interest that the bar has, and we'll continue to have in our work. I understand that my colleague Aida Ford is online. Hello, Aida.
Yeah.
You're square, but I
She's
didn't find it, but
yeah,
I can
she's
feel
what
your presence.
Right here.
Oh, there she is. So very glad that
Maybe she
Aida's
could
here as well.
introduce, we could have her introduce herself. And if you
I think
all,
that would be very good.
if you guys don't know the group, maybe we could just go around and quickly say hello. Or do you feel like you all know everyone?
Well, that would be lovely
Yeah,
if we
okay.
could, if
Yeah.
there's time to do
Yeah,
so. Thank you. But
we'll
if
try
I,
to.
I'll, well, this is my first year as chair of the commission. I was asked by my colleagues on the commission to take this role. I'd never say that I am filling the shoes of the great Emmett Sullivan. No one can do that. But I was asked to take this role on. I'm a bit of an unorthodox person to be sitting in this seat, in that I'm not a lawyer, but I birthed one, and I've worked closely with the profession over my career, and continue. I did serve two stints as chair of the Council of Court Excellence, and have great respect for the DC bar. We have
Sure.
probably the best bar in the land, I think. That would be easily safe to say.
Yes.
So, with that, I'm going to stop and then turn it over to Aida to
Yes.
introduce herself.
Hi, greetings, colleagues. My name is Yaida Ford. It's good to see everyone. I love being with my people. I'm your pick for the JNC. I think I was appointed in 2021, so I'm going into my second year serving on the JNC. Sorry I couldn't be there in person. You all know what I do for a living. And I'm getting ready for a trial nonetheless, but I just want to thank everybody. It's good to be seen and heard, even though I can't feel you and be in your presence. I just want to say it's been great working with Tracy and Marie this year and during my term, and I hope I'm doing you all justice as lawyers who want to see good judges in our Court of Appeals and in our DC Superior Court, particularly.
Thank you. Why don't we stay with the screen and just go quickly across? I'll start with Mark.
Yeah. Excuse me. Good afternoon, Mark Salzberg. Nice to meet you both.
Mark is our treasurer elect.
I apologize. Yes, I'm the treasurer elect. Yes. I was trying to be brief.
Okay. June.
And I can't mention Council for Court Excellence without also mentioning June Kress. Hi, June.
I just wish I could be there in person, but you wouldn't want me there because I've got my first bout of COVID. I'm doing fine. Oh. It's really great to see you, Tracy, and you, Marie, and we are very lucky to have you here today.
I see Courtney.
Hi, Courtney Weiner. I'm in my second term on the board, and good to see everyone.
And Ramya?
Hi, Ramya Ravindran, also my second term on the board, and like June, am dealing with illness, so you're glad I'm not there in person either. But good to see everyone.
Okay, is there anyone else that I'm missing on screen? Looks like everyone else is sort of here. So, Steve, why don't we start with you, go around. Speak up, guys. Speak up.
And it's my first term on the board.
Yes.
Nice to meet you.
My name is Roger Phillips, and I'm the secretary of the board.
Ryan Flowers. This is my first term on the board.
Thank you. Nanny Koss. This is my second term on the board. This is my second term. I'm Sally here. I've had the pleasure of working with Marie for many years on all sorts of legal issues
and don't stand. Hello, Pat English, first term, first year on board.
Hello, good afternoon. I'm Kelly Martin. I'm the executive director of the DC Bar of Hills.
Welcome, Kate O'Neill's general counsel.
I know you guys. Yeah. Not special.
Charles Lowry.
Sean Snyder, president elect.
Hello, nice to see you all. Ella Jakovic, immediate
pastor. Yes, nice to see you again.
Hi, I'm Andrea Mangrovich. This is my first term on the board after being president. Second year.
Hi, I'm Diane Seltzer. It's my first term, third year, and I was secretary before this.
Hello, my name is Alicia Long, and it is also my first year and first term, and I am the current treasurer. Nice to meet you.
When in the back behind, we have some great representatives of the DC Bar staff, but we thought we'd just go ahead and turn it over to you guys to tell us, to talk with us. So, Tracy.
Right, well, I'll just say a couple of introductory things, because Tracy really is the one you want to hear from, because Tracy is, she is the one who knows all about the science of managing the commission, and she does a phenomenal job. Very small staff, Tracy and one other staff person, and they, again, under Tracy's leadership, an amazing job of keeping all the trains running and managing a very complex scheduling process. I mentioned I made a bit of a joke about me being an unorthodox pick for chair, but I want to just give a little more color to my background that hopefully will make anyone who's in the room who's concerned feel a little bit more comfortable. I believe that it's important, and I've said this often in my term on the commission. This actually have completed my second term, my first term, I'm sorry. I have a hearing coming up on the 21st. Before Council Chair Mendelson, regarding my reappointment. So I've been on the commission for quite a few years, and I also have the honor of having served for probably about 10 or 12 years now on the DC Law Enforcement Nomination Commission, which, as I'm sure you know, is Congresswoman Norton's commission that is activated. Previously has been activated under Democratic presidential terms, where our Congresswoman, since we are the last colony, our Congresswoman is given senatorial privileges as it relates to the federal vacancy. So I have had some experience with sitting on the commissions, both of which, both the Federal Law Enforcement Commission. Yes, sir. May I call you back? I'm actually in Mars. Okay, thank you. Was one of our judges. So I had some experience with the process, and I've always very interested when I'm talking to individuals who are applying for vacancies to ask them about their service in the community. What do they know about the community outside of the law? Because as a layperson, it's very important to me that people who serve on the bench, and I just think in the profession, period, any profession, it's important for us to be outside of our bubbles, because we have too much bubble thinking, I believe, too much bubble decision making. And for the judiciary, I find it very important for people to understand the community and the various components of the community to help them as they're taking on these weighty roles. And so I think that should carry over to the commission to show that the commission also is diverse in terms of its membership. Two members of the commission by design are lay members. So myself, currently those are myself, those members are myself, and in my heart, council chair forever, Linda Kropp. So council chair Kropp is currently on the commission as well. She's been a terrific addition. Everyone else, of course, our members, all the other members are members of the bar. So I bring to this role my 30 plus years of business leadership, retired from Verizon. I have a small, I currently operate a small business here in the district and have done a lot of community involvement across my many years here. This is my adopted home. My family and I have lived in the city for nearly 40 years. I'm originally from the Midwest, and this is home. I love this city. I feel fortunate to be here and particularly blessed to be in this very important role. So with that, I'll turn to our executive director, our esteemed executive director, Tracy Nuttall, who'll tell you a little bit more about the process and how the commission works.
Sure. But before I do that, let me just say that this past year working with Marie has been great. She has kept the she has truly kept us on task. She and Ben, who serves as co-chair. So I appreciate working with Marie. She has taught me much in her quiet way. Mm-hmm. And so I appreciate her. Just so you all who may not be familiar with the commissioners, I support Cecilia and I, who is a staff person. We support the seven commissioners, one of whom is appointed by the president. Two are appointed by the, one is appointed by DC Council, that would be Marie. Mm-hmm. Two are appointed by the mayor. You all appoint two, and then one appointment by the U.S. District Court. And so they all bring their background experiences to the commission, and it has been a pleasure to work with the seven members and the two you all, have you recently appointed, we have enjoyed working with. And so just as an overview, the JNC, we are activated when we have information about a vacancy due to a retirement, a vacancy due to a resignation, a vacancy due to the expiration of someone's term, a vacancy due to some sort of challenge that a judge may have that will require a resignation. And so once that vacancy occurs, we, as Marie would say, we're scrambling with what is our timeline? What does the statute say with regard to when we must send names to the president? And sometimes it's a very quick turnaround, as is the vacancy that we have now due to the elevation of Judge Ali Khan to the U.S. District Court. We have 60 days from the date of her appointment by the president to send names to the White House. So as you can imagine, during the Christmas holidays, we're just sort of saying, ooh, how do we do that? But the JNC, I'm proud to say, has never missed a deadline. And I do not intend to have a deadline missed under my watch. And so we continue to work very, very diligently to make sure we send those names to the president. So what does that look like? Well, on the front end, the process involves posting the vacancy, answering questions from those who might be interested. This is during the time when the vacancy is open and the time and the deadline. And that happens. So we have open conference calls every Monday and sometimes on Fridays if the money doesn't work when it conflicts with the holiday, where I make myself available to anyone who wants to call and ask any questions. Under Judge Sullivan's leadership, I think the process was opened a little bit more. And so we welcome questions. We're not engaged in a hazing process. If you want to know, we'll give you as much information as we can give you. Oftentimes, one of the challenges is people don't ask questions and then they run into problems and we may not be able to move forward with their application because they may have missed something. So once the application closes, then we engage in the investigation process where we inquire into the candidates or the applicant's background. So once they've met the statutory requirements for residency, DC practice, the U.S. citizenship, those sort of basic minimum requirements, then we begin to look at them a little bit closely. And letters of recommendation start to come in. They aren't required in our process, but we welcome them. And the commissioners, I must say, they actually read them and they look at them. And so they are helpful, I would suspect, in some instances to the commissioners. And after we have engaged in the investigation process, we do invite all new applicants to the process. We invite them to an interview before all the commissioners. Prior to the interview, applicants can reach out to the commissioners and request a one-on-one interview. If schedule and time permits before the larger body meeting, then commissioners will meet one-on-one with the applicants. And after the interviews, the commissioners do what they do behind closed doors to deliberate, and then they reach a level of consensus, if I may use that word, Marie, because I'm not a part of that. But they reach a level of consensus, and then those they identify three names per three individuals per vacancy, send those names to the White House, and the JNC's process is technically closed. It has ended at that particular point once we send those names to the White House. But we're always watching. We stay tuned to what's happening. We engage with the White House Counsel's Office to say, hey, when are those nominees coming out? Is the president, what is it looking like? And so we talk with White House Counsel's Office periodically just to get a sense of what the president's thinking, or not thinking, but when he will nominate. And then once those nominations are made, we follow what's happening on the Senate, which is interesting, as you all can imagine, is interesting. And then once a confirmation is had, we celebrate in the way, only the way JNC could, and that's with some high fives and cheers and all that kind of good stuff, because whew, we did that. And that's essentially our process. And Marie could speak more to what the commissioners do, but it's what happens with the commissioners that really make for what we believe to be a very diverse and smart bench. And so we're proud of the confirmations and the judges who have resulted from the JNC's process so far.
Well, thank you for that information. Would you all want questions from us, or how? One question that comes up quite a bit, or has come up in our meetings with the chief judges, is the need for the vacancies that currently exist, you know, at the Superior Court level in particular. Do you all do anything? I know you're sort of responding to the vacancies, but helping us fill the vacancies that currently exist.
Well, Tracy mentioned Ben Wilson, whom I'm sure many of you know. fantastic lawyer and an excellent member of the commission. And when I was asked to serve as chair, I asked Ben to serve as vice chair. So we work very much as a team. And one thing that Ben, Tracy, and I decided early on is that we were going to be intentional about being in contact with the White House counsel's office and talking about our concerns with the number of vacancies, because for those of us who live here, it has a direct impact on quality of life when we don't have a fully impaneled bench. So we have met with White House counsel's office on a few occasions. I mean, we certainly are very judicious about not being not taking too much advantage of having time with them, but we did use the opportunity of new people coming into roles, use that as an opportunity to reach out. Tracy has more regular contact with the White House counsel staff, but we are definitely in touch with them on a regular basis and continue to raise the issues of asking what can we do. You know, it is the White House, so of course we have to, you know, manage the relationship carefully, but always approaching them from the standpoint, what can we do to help in any way? I mean, there is, as Tracy says, once the names go over, the ball is definitely in their court, and we have no other formal part of the process. But we do stay in touch on a regular basis, just to make sure that they know we're here, we're watching, and they're eager for the process to play out in full.
So let me just share a few numbers. There are two vacancies on the Court of Appeals, one that's most recent, and one that's been open for about 10 years now, Judge Oberle's vacancy. And so we're hopeful that once we send those names, perhaps the White House will send up two nominees, one for Ali Khan and one for Oberle, because that's been sitting there for a period. There are 12 vacancies on the Superior Court, and the White House has nominees for most of them, all but three. All but two, actually. So seven names are currently pending before the Senate that we're hopeful that the Senate may be confirmed by December 15th. So our fingers are crossed, they're ready to go. They just need the vote. And so if those seven are confirmed by the end of this week, then that will make a huge difference on those seven vacancies on the Superior Court. But as Marie said, once the JNC sends the names, our role is completed. Our official role is completed. Unless there's something that triggers us to be able to open a vacancy again, our hands are sort of tied. The clock kind of stops, and we're just sort of trying to figure out what is it that we can do from an official capacity. And more often than not, there really isn't a whole lot we can do.
Brian, go ahead.
Did I just hear you? One vacancy has existed for 10 or
20
days.
10. The Oberle vacancy.
Oberle, yes.
But the other question I have is, what is the public role? Does the public have an opportunity to weigh in? I know that you're a deliberative body.
To weigh in. To weigh in on the JNC process, yes, or the
judges who are applying or not. So I know you issue a lot of notices.
Oh, yeah.
So
public comment, as soon as we close the vacancy, which will be in this instance, will close on January the 8th, we send out notice and we invite public comment. So we have a electronic way in which the public can weigh in on candidates. The public can write letters, they can send email, there is a survey through SurveyMonkey, so the public can correspond with us, and we will make that a part of the applicant's file. And I'll send that information to the commissioners. And I believe they're very conscientious about hearing from the public. They invite comments from the public.
And I'll just add to that, if I may. And our convention on the commission is that, for example, if someone approaches me at church, or if I get a letter from someone about a particular applicant, then I make sure that I communicate the substance of that interaction with all the commission. So we'll either send an email to everyone saying, you know, I talked to Jane Doe, and this is what the conversation was, or if I get a letter, any commissioner gets a letter, that letter becomes part, as Tracy said, of the person's file. So we share information that we receive from the public. And as far as the applicants themselves, we also have the convention of if applicants are interested in doing so, many commissioners make themselves available for a conversation prior to their formal interview with the full commission.
Any other questions, comments?
I had a question, Murray. Beyond writing comments about specific candidates, what I recall when I was at the Council for Court Excellence, we wrote letter upon letter to members of Congress. Is that something that the commission is interested in getting the public to do? There were a number of times when candidates, judicial candidates, were like stuck. And, you know, given the uncertainty about what Congress is up to these days, is that something that you would advocate that the public should be doing or not?
Well, I think more voices from the district citizens are that we should make our views known to Congress. In fact, there was a letter sent by the council. Keep me honest, please. Tracy, wasn't there a letter just last week? Members of the city council sent to the executive branch. I think it was to the White House.
It was actually to the Senate Judiciary
Committee. To the Judiciary Committee. Yeah. So short answer, yes. It doesn't hurt. It does not hurt for the federal policymakers to hear from the citizens in a variety of ways.
So, Mr. Flowers, directly, we invite public comment for our process. Once we send the names to the White House, I'm not sure if they invite public comment.
Yeah,
I'm not sure. I'm not sure if the Senate invites public comment, but we invite public comment in evaluating whether three individuals should be sent to the president for his consideration.
Ellen, and then Sally.
Yes. Thank you. And thank you three for all the great work you are doing, as well as your fellow commissioners. Two questions. One, you mentioned there is a seat on the Court of Appeals, Judge Oberle's seat, that's been open for 10 years. Is there a story behind that and why that's not been filled? And then second, what can we as the DC Bar do to help make sure that these vacancies, once you send the names on and the White House, you know, gives the nominations, or anything we can do that would help this process and help get the candidates confirmed?
Sure. So in 2013, I believe when Judge Oberle retired, the JNC opened the vacancy, sent names to the White House, and the president can select one of those three names or anybody who's pending for that particular court. So they're not just restricted to the three names we sent for that particular vacancy, but as long as those candidates, the vacancy for which we sent names remains open, the president can consider any name. And at that time, the first, I believe it was Mr. Kim, Todd Kim, whose name went up, and Bob, you probably have a better memory of the conflict surrounding, you know, what happened to him on the Hill in the Senate, and why he did not move forward. It's unfortunate that he did not move forward. Todd, I believe, was great. I wasn't working for the JSC at the time. I experienced him in the Court of Appeals, but he didn't make it. And so at that particular time, I don't think the JSC had a mechanism for reopening the vacancy. So it just sort of sat there for a period of time because the president could renominate someone else. And I don't believe, I wasn't there at the time, but I don't believe the president renominated so that
the JSC, we didn't have a statutory trigger to reopen the vacancy. The president didn't do anything. And then the JSC did some rulemaking so that we can find a way to reopen stale vacancies. That happened. We reopened Judge Oberle's vacancy in 2020. So recently, we reopened the vacancy, sent three new names to the White House. We've had a couple of Court of Appeals vacancies since then. The White House did not act on that pool of candidates. And now, so I don't know what the White House is thinking, but they must not like the names that we sent. I don't know. It's, for some reason, they have not moved.
So it's just sitting now.
Wow. And so we're hoping that, okay, we have another bite at the apple. So this vacancy, we think the Ali Khan vacancy, we think is important. We think it's very important because it's not likely we'll get another Court of Appeals vacancy for a period of time. It's consequential. So we're hoping that if we send three strong candidates, so you all tell everybody you know who's interested, if we send three strong candidates, maybe the White House will select two people, one for Ali Khan and one for Oberle, and we can get that vacancy closed.
Okay, right. Thank you.
So you had asked Alan what the bar could do post, yes. and Tracy went right to what I was thinking pre selection. That's where the bar can play a very strong role, and that is to make sure that we have the strongest pool possible. Because as Tracy said, this is our shot to hopefully get set a pool strong enough that the White House will take two names.
Got it.
Thank you very much.
Is your sense, Marie, that the people you're getting within this 60-day window are a strong representation and good so far? Or are you getting?
We've had good applicant pools. But we have to continue to work. I mean, the royal we. To continue to have strong, diverse pools, so the people who represent a diversity of experience, diversity of life story, all of that is important.
Yeah.
And let me share this. This is from Chief Blackman Rigsby during a conversation we recently had. She was wondering, you all get so many great applicants for the Superior Court, and I look at their bios and I wonder, why didn't they apply to the Court of Appeals? And so we don't know why some of the applicants we get 20 applicants, for example, for the Superior Court, and maybe get 10 or 12 for the Court of Appeals. We don't know, but we're saying, and I think the chief would say, you might be ready. Just give it a shot and let's see what happens. And so we're not sure what the barrier is for applicants applying to the Court of Appeals, but we definitely get more applicants to the Superior Court, and we sort of have a pipeline. We're familiar with many of the applicants. We get new applicants, but we're familiar with them. The Court of Appeals, when we get a Court of Appeals vacancy, it's like we're starting the slate very clean. Because we haven't seen people in a while. Mm-hmm. The last period was 2 years ago where we're looking at people anew. So the process is a little bit more challenging for us. We're going to get it done, but we would love to see applicants, just as many applicants for the Court of Appeals as we get for the Superior Court.
I just had a brief question. Could you tell us a little bit about the difference between confirmation on the local courts and confirmation federally in the Senate, because it's not the same, correct?
Okay.
They go before two different committees, judiciary,
Homeland Security and Government Affairs.
So they're two different constituencies in the Senate. And so if we were going to take some effort on behalf of our membership, it would be to the Homeland Security Committee rather than the Senate Judiciary Committee.
For Superior Court, you're saying?
And Court of Appeals.
Yes, there are two different committees involved. So that's correct.
Getting things through.
Right. So again, yeah, we can't speak to their process.
Yeah.
I would not want to, right, because I don't know it.
I was thinking our process. And
yeah.
Who we would lobby, if correct, anybody.
So if I could just weigh in for a second, we, as you might imagine, we care about this very much, since we're practicing in those courts all the time. And we see, whether it's for paying clients or pro bono clients, the impact of having 20-25% fewer Superior Court judges than there ought to be is significant. We regularly have this conversation with both Chief Judge Blackburn Rigsby and Chief Judge Josie Herring about how the bar can support their efforts. The one thing that we've tried very carefully to do is not get crosswise with the courts in the message that they would like to go to the committee in the confirmation process, because they're having their own conversations there. And we want to just make sure that we're all working in concert. And previously, we would also talk to Judge Sullivan about, is there anything that we can do? And we stand ready. Anything that the bar can do to support. We just don't want to be out there on a limb and saying things and doing things that are not exactly where the courts want us to be. We are obviously a creation of the Court of Appeals. We want to make sure that we're acting in concert and supporting the commission's work as best we possibly can. And from an operational standpoint, obviously we push out the vacancies as wide as we can. We talk about them here in the room. We invite the chief judges in to come and talk about the impact on the courts. We meet with the voluntary bars on a monthly basis. We regularly encourage them and their members to apply for the positions. Some of us have been through the process one or two times ourselves.
Let's do it again.
So we are ready to help anything that we can do, but we do want to make sure that we're doing it, yeah, in a way that makes sense given the players. And it does make a difference, right? It does make a difference about whether it is a friendly Senate committee or an unfriendly Senate committee to the interests of the local population of the District of Columbia. And so we just have to be kind of careful about what we do. But we have done letters in multiple administrations. We've had conversations. We've had meetings. And anything that you think that we can do to help, again, with support of the court, we are happy to do.
Well, thank you for re-emphasizing that. We know how what an important role the DC Bar has played over time. And so and we welcome that support. And I also agree with you, Bob, on the importance of coordinated effort. Because, again, these are high political stakes, and particularly in these days. So we have to always be mindful of how we, you know, make our points, and that we're doing it in a cohesive, coordinated fashion.
But for me, the immediate need is for you all to just speak directly to your the attorneys in the bar to say, hey, we need you to apply. And you need to pull that application before you think about it, opening a Christmas present. Just pause life for the next 20, 25 days, because we're not sure when the next Court of Appeals vacancy will occur. We hope the Court of Appeals will be fully staffed by the end of next year. I recently spoke with White House Counsel's office about filling this vacancy and was assured, or at least was told that their desire is to get this vacancy filled by the end of the year, and that some of the holdup, I don't think it's going to come from the White House Counsel's office, it takes time for them to get their stuff done because they're waiting on an FBI background check, which could take more than 60 days in and of itself. But I think some of the holdup might be, again, in that Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs office. But if we can at least get the names to the White House as quickly as possible, which we'll do if the White House can get a nominee through, which we think they have picked up in their process. I think they nominated six people, cutting down those old vacancies to two, which is great. So to only have two vacancies without a nominee from sitting from our seat, we're much better off this year than we were last year. And so we're hopeful that we'll get some confirmations before they go out on holiday. And that would be a huge success or win for the JNC.
Okay.
I'm sort of understanding you as to that you're getting some implicit feedback as to the quality of the candidates, but it may not be explicit. Is that, do I have that correct? Are you getting explicit feedback from the White House about the candidates that are being selected?
Not often,
right? But we're reading the tea leaves.
Yeah, not often. But I'll give you an example of explicit feedback. But it's generally quite highly nuanced. But an example of some explicit feedback that we received that has caused us to ensure that we're built to make this into our process is that we got feedback that an application contained an error or two. Nothing major, because I mean, Tracy, we all looking, you know, I think we're all proofreaders at heart, everyone on the commission. So somehow something slipped by and there was a misspelling or a name was put in the wrong place or something. And that was commented on during one of our conversations. We were asking, you know, if we need feedback, and that was brought up. So a process change that we have made is when we emphasize the importance of being absolutely pristine with any documents. And we also emphasize for applicants that the JNC is a process within itself, but it's the first phase of a multi-step process. And to know that once your materials, if you are fortunate to be on the list that goes to the White House, that the clock starts over, the review process starts afresh, and to make sure that everything is absolutely perfect. And we also emphasize that our process is when we the commission has voted, then I make calls to the three individuals whose names will go forward. And again, emphasize that point that you will have X number of hours or whatever Tracy allows for them to do yet another review. We urge them to have another set of eyes on all of their materials, again, just to make sure that there's nothing. And a few times, even with that, people have made some tweaks here and there. So
think about it. It's not, the White House is basically saying, before we can disqualify something simply because they misspelled their name. We're not even looking for the real stuff, nitty gritty. We're just going to disqualify on the face. Now that might be important, hugely important. So it's something as significant or insignificant as that. And I was devastated because I missed it. I can't catch everything. So that's why we continually say, read, get someone you love to review your materials. And as Marie said, we baked into our process another window of time where we say, hey, look at these few documents one more time. And if you misspell something, don't change the substance, but if there's a misspelling, can you, or if something, the date is incorrect, can you fix it? Just look at one more time. More often than not, we haven't had any changes. And we haven't had a whole lot of pushback on that. But we're trying to make sure the applicants present as well as possible.
Well, I think that we want to thank you all for coming. We're going to try to keep moving, you know, on our agenda. But this has been, I think the board would agree, this has been really helpful, informative. And that's the purpose of our board meeting, is to have discussions like this. So.
Well, again, thank you for the invitation.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Come back whenever.
Yeah.
Yes. And hopefully December 15th will.
Yeah. Last year, December 15th, we got through about six or seven people. And so we're hoping the same will happen this year.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you all. Thank you. Thank you. So now we're going to go to Elaine. Is that right? Okay. And we're going to do our legal ethics committee and report. I'm sorry, you know, we're way behind, guys. We're going to try to speed up and get our committee reports in. And
like a congressional hearing.
Hello, Hope and Elaine. We're welcome. The Legal Ethics Committee report. We welcome you, and we're sorry for the delay. We're trying to get as many reports in as we can. So we'll just turn it over to you all, and then we'll see if there are any questions from our board members here or those on the screen. Okay.
Okay, great. Hi, I'm Elaine Bloch. I'm the chair of the Legal Ethics Committee this year. This is the final year of my second term, so I'm about to term out of the Legal Ethics Committee. It's been a really great experience. Excuse me. As you all know, the Legal Ethics Committee exists to provide advice about interpretation and application of the rules. They can be, as we all know, you know, they're clear when you read them, but a lot harder to apply, as is always the case with, I guess, all rules, to specific situations. We answer questions that, well, we can receive or we can issue opinions on the basis of various different ways of receiving questions. We sometimes have been asked for a legal ethics opinion by a member of the legal community. Sometimes we get a great suggestion from our counsel after they have received questions on the helpline and they perhaps have noticed a trend or they received a particularly important question with a lot of relevance to a broad sector or broad a lot of people. And we also sometimes just decide that we think that an opinion should be issued about some subject that is worrying or concerning one of us or all of us. The committee is comprised of 11 lawyers and 4 non-lawyers, all of whom have equal voting rights. The non-lawyers in particular, I always am very grateful that we have non-lawyers on the committee because they really bring a perspective. Lawyers tend to be a bit myopic about, you know, how we're looking at these rules, and they can speak for the people who are going to be using the services of the lawyers. And also, of course, they bring their own special expertise, which is so invaluable. So I just think it's worth noting the great contribution that they make. So as you all see from your report, in fiscal year 2022, the Legal Ethics Committee published 2 legal ethics opinions. The first one was a short opinion about interpreting communications that lawyers can make to mainly incarcerated people who were already are represented by a lawyer, because the committee was concerned about safeguarding a person's right to fire their lawyer and choose a lawyer that they would like to hire, but also about the possibility that in some instances a lawyer will kind of aggressively seek to have someone hire them when that person is already represented. So that's we really just provided some guidelines about how that works and how quickly whether or not a lawyer who is engaged by a person in that situation, what they can do with the fee. They have to hold it in trust until they have notified the existing counsel and also filed their notice with the court. We also issued opinion 385, which was about this is actually really interesting, advising clients about communications with represented parties under Rule 4.2. As you all know, you can't do that, right? A lawyer can't communicate with a represented party without consent of that party's lawyer. But under comment 4.22, the rules make clear that a party can communicate with another party, that parties to the matter are not limited by
the rule. So the trick is in determining where this rule, how this rule applies when a lawyer is advising their client about communicating with the party opponent, a represented party, and how far a lawyer can go before they have basically circumvented the rule, before they are using their client as a surrogate. And basically the rule said, hey, you can advise your client. You can tell your client it's a good idea. You can help your client decide what they want to talk about. You can even help your client come up with talking points. You can prepare your client, but you can't participate in any way. You can't listen in. You also can't prepare a binding legal document for your client to take it. And this was a matter of really extensive discussion among the legal ethics committee, exactly where that line should be drawn to us, what made sense to us, so that we could respect the rule and also respect the reality of the comment, or the reality that the comment reflects. So those were our two opinions in fiscal year 2022. We also have published recently an opinion. What the heck was it? I'm forgetting.
Aggregate settlements,
right. The aggregate settlements opinion, which basically helps lawyers understand their responsibilities when they are representing multiple clients, and the fact that they have to make sure that each and every client gives written consent to the settlement. They can't give advance consent. The lawyer can't agree that there will be majority rules or anything like that. Each and every client is obligated the lawyer is required to get consent from each and every client independently in order to meet their ethical obligations. And we also have two pending opinions, one that's about to be very shortly will be published. We're at the very tail end of the process. That one addresses duties of outside counsel. And we have one in the works that will offer guidance on what else? AI. So that one is going to be interesting for us. I'm sure it's going to be maybe not one of the easiest ones we have had to draft. There may be a lot of discussion about it. I imagine there will be. It's an interesting topic, as we all know. And the draft opinion is very good, I'll tell you that. And the only other thing that is noted in this report, and it really is very interesting, is that we, the Legal Ethics Committee, went through the board approval process in order to file a public statement, in this case, an amicus brief with the Court of Appeals, when the Court of Appeals was interpreting its own prior opinion, as the opinion was called Pons, as that opinion, I see some nodding, as that opinion itself interpreted Rule 115E, which is the degree, the rule is, it addresses fees, and it's the degree of consent required under that rule, whether or not the lawyer had to get informed consent confirmed in writing. And the plain language of the rule does not require that, unlike some rules. And therefore we thought, well, hey, you know, it was a matter of fair play. Yeah, really should only require what the plain language of the rule requires. Court of Appeals didn't see it exactly that way. And they imposed the requirement of a writing in order to accept an advance fee and for the lawyer to put it in their own operating account. And it wasn't that the Legal Ethics Committee thought, oh no, there should be no writings. It wasn't that at all. It was that we really were looking at the rules and just thinking, hey, you know, the rule doesn't require that, and maybe the rule should be changed, but as written, the rule didn't require that. So that is what the Legal Ethics Committee has been up to for the last couple of years, I guess, now. If anyone has any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them. Thank goodness Hope is here. Oh, and I really should and must note that we have the most amazing support from Hope and her team of incredible lawyers who really keep us on track and really help us cut through the confusion.
Yay. Okay, any questions? Anyone on the screen? I don't see any hands. Anyone here?
Lucky for me, I would have been nervous if I'd known that many
people
were here.
Yeah. Well.
No.
Okay. Andrea, did you have a?
Oh no, it's mostly just us.
Right. Oh. Okay.
On the screen. Yeah.
Okay. Well,
anyway, it's been a real pleasure serving on the Legal Ethics Committee. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your service. Thank you.
Is Shari. Shari's here.
She's
okay. Shari, I see you on the screen.
Yes.
We're going to turn to you since we're into committee reports for a report on the Communities Committee, their annual report.
Great. Thank you. I'm Shari Brown. I'm the chair of the DC Bar Communities Committee, and I'm a former co-chair of the International Law Community. So I have a great affinity for communities programming and issues. First, you have our report. I'm not going to cover everything on it. I direct your attention to the fact that we are supporting more programming and networking opportunities, including in-person, online, and also podcasts. And we've also continued to reach out to the youth, as you can see, by holding a youth fair. And our DC Cup Moot Court competition was a success this year. The tax community, which was the community of the year, continues its juggernaut participation and event programming. It had the most programs of any community. And then I want to drill down a little bit on some of our other programming that was well attended. As you can see, wellness, family law, on a primer on the amended Superior Court probate rules, SEC rules. But I also asked Pam Robinson for some more detail on our podcast. This is a relatively new platform for programming. We had 49 podcasts, but I was so thrilled to see these numbers that on our Brief Encounters podcast for the fiscal year, we had what is 1,500 plays or 1,500 times people listened to that podcast. But even more impressively, the international law community does an international arbitration podcast called The Tea on Arbitration. And it had over 3,460 plays for the fiscal year. 3,460 plays. No other programming has numbers like that in the thousands. So these new formats and platforms that we are introducing, whether it's online or podcasts, really have an audience, and we are reaching a broader audience. And then finally, I want to highlight some of the accomplishments. Obviously, you've been hearing from Ellen Jakovic about the formation of the Early Career Lawyers Community, which basically applies to those who have been practicing for under 10 years, and that is formed. It has leadership. And then, as you probably know from the DC Bar Community's office, they reconfigured the membership so that you can have unlimited communities memberships for one fee, as opposed to what happened before, which caused a decrease in community membership. But one of the most important things to me is that we had the accomplishment of inviting the leaders, the steering committee leaders and chairs of all the communities over the last year to come and share their goals with the Communities Committee and any opportunities for the DC Bar community staff and our committee to help facilitate their goals. And they all responded positively by coming and letting us know what they hope to do and how we can help them. And some of the things that we helped them with were they asked us for more in-person programming, and DC Bar Communities Office worked with them, and now everyone, every community will be able to have more than one in-person program. I believe it's four now. They asked us for more access for those who are financially limited to DC bar programming, whether they're lawyers or non-lawyers, but they're interested broadly in some of the more cross-disciplinary issues. And DC Bar Communities Office, working with the Communities Committee, also responded positively by making more free programming available for DC lawyers and non-lawyers upon a community leader's request. They asked for more marketing help and support from the DC Bar Communities Office. And all the feedback from those leaders is that has been provided. They asked for more cross-community programming and collaboration. And DC Bar Communities Office, with support from the Communities Committee, has facilitated that. They asked for help with those communities that didn't have a full steering committee, because a lot of people didn't want to run for steering committee in an election. And with the help of DC Bar Communities Office and the Communities Committee, we came up with a procedure for appointing on an interim basis steering committee members, so that all communities have a full quota of steering committees. They asked for help on expedited reviews of public statements that they wanted to issue, that the Communities Committee had to review, and we put in place a more streamlined procedure for that. And that is directly as a result of these communities, steering committees and leaders coming to our community committee meeting monthly and sharing with us what their goals were, what their challenges were, and how we can help. And the feedback on the responsiveness of the DC Bar Communities Office to their requests and the Communities Committee of responsiveness has been very positive. But I should say that the DC Bar Communities Office is a little shy about bragging about themselves, so that's why I had to bring this up for you. And then, as you can see, we've had more positive revenue picture this year over the last fiscal year, and we expect to do even better, I think, in this fiscal year, because more members have signed up for communities. And with that, I have completed our communities report. Thank you.
Thank you, Shari. Any questions, comments? Shari?
I just wanted to add that sort of bragging on the staff. Number one, they are amazing. Pam's done a terrific job in a short time here. And the turnaround that Shari mentioned about the new membership value model, where you can, for one fee, join as many communities as you want, has been a resounding success. We are about almost 17,000 communities members now, over the roughly 11,000 last year. And about 800 of those members are with the Early Career Lawyers community, brand new. So I think that really speaks well for the program, for the idea behind the ECLC, and kudos to the committee for putting in so much time and effort to think about how to improve the experience for all the communities members. So thanks.
And Bob, you already stole my kudos for the community staff. And as Shari explained, they've done a terrific job in responding to the community steering committee's concerns and asks for help. And I also want to give a huge shout out to Shari. She put in place so many of these programs to hear from our community's members. It was her, at her instigation, that we invited the leaders of the steering committees in to talk about what was working, what didn't, how we could help them. And Shari, you've done an amazing job listening with empathy, listening with direction, making sure that there was a goal at the end of the day to improve the situation for our community. So thank you so much for your leadership.
Thank you, Shari. Thank you. Thank you, Shari, so much.
And with that, I think I am allowed to leave. And yes, you can get on with your other important business, correct?
Thank you.
Thanks, Shari.
Okay, thank you so
bye-bye.
Much.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Bye now. Bye. We're kind of out of order in our agenda, but I know it's we're getting close to our ending time. But if you guys can hang in here for a few more minutes, we'll try to get through the agenda and the executive session quickly. So I'm going to pass on the president's report. I wanted to go to the treasurer's report, Bob's report, and then we could take up these action items. How's that?
Okay.
Okay.
So I apologize. It's going to be a little bit of deja vu. we'll start. So I'm reporting on the financial results for the bar through September 2023. Revenue is running about 1% below budget due to timing issues. Expenditures are performing better than the budget through the end of the first quarter of the fiscal year 2024. Here are the key takeaways for the first 3 months of the year. Go to slide two. Mara's already on it. The bar ended September with a surplus from operations of $692,000, which was better than what we budgeted by $451,000. Year-to-date revenue was $10.3 million, which was less than budgeted by 1%, and expenses were $9.6 million, which was less than budgeted by 5%. We have less than budgeted results for license fees due to timing. When we expected to recognize the revenue versus when we actually recognized it, we also had lower than expected royalties revenue from deferred events and timing. Rental space to external users, community dues, and on-demand classes in book and publication were all better than what was budgeted. The increase in net assets of $122,000 is the result of the $692,000 surplus from operations minus investment losses of $524,000 and a net $46,000 in clients security fund disbursements. And then moving on to slide three, license fee funded activities through the end of September show a surplus of $390,000. Which was better than what we budgeted by $316,000. Expenses were less than budget, with savings in equipment, lease, and services. Supplies and miscellaneous primarily related to building costs. We are currently showing savings attributable to timing and professional fees, staff development, and printing and copying. These may decrease as the year progresses and actual expenses catch up to what was budgeted. As mentioned earlier, we also had a lower than budgeted revenue related to the timing of the recognition of license fees. Okay. For non-license fee funded activities, communities had a surplus of $47,000 from operations, which was better than budgeted by $79,000. Communities revenue during license renewal improved over the last year to an adjustment in the renewal process, allowing pre-population of the community's memberships. Communities also recognize expense savings, primarily in personnel vacancies. CLE had a surplus of $68,000 from operations, which was $20,000 better than budgeted. Passport sales within the admissions and registration saw increased revenue due to its addition to the license fee renewal process, contributing to CLE revenue greater than budgeted by $15,000 in the quarter. Cost savings and professional fees due to fewer presenters added to the favorable operation results. The overall CLE program, which includes the mandatory course and rules education, generated a surplus from operations of $159,000, which was $126,000 better than budget. Other non-license fee funded activities, which include certificates of good standing, royalties related to member benefit affinity programs, and rentals of rooms and the studio to outside clients generated a surplus of $188,000 from operations, which was $36,000 more than what we budgeted. Overall revenue was less than we expected by 2% due to royalties revenue, which was projected to be received in later months and budgeted that way. Expense savings of $41,000, primarily from the shift of Practice 360 event to October. Offset the revenue deficit. And then finally, we had $116 million in total assets. Our cash balance was $21 million and our investment balance was $15.7 million at the end of September. Compared to this same time last year, our cash increased by $2.5 million and our investments increased by $1.8 million. Market volatility continues, however, as we did experience a decline in the value of our investment portfolio of 3% during the first quarter of this fiscal year. The balance of our building's mortgage, which comes due in August 2037, with $49 million. And this concludes my report of the DC Bar's results through September 30th, 2023.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Alicia. We'll now turn to our CEO's report.
This will be a speed report here. Just three things to say. Number one, thank you all for showing up at the holiday party last week. It was wonderful. I have to say, I think it was the best in-person big event we've had, at least my view, since we've been back in the building after the pandemic. Stacy and Ashley and all the facilities crew knocked it out of the park. And if you knew the drama that had occurred right before everybody showed up, you'd even appreciate a little bit more, but it was great. Number two, in your materials, it actually went out by email, but uploaded on the portal, are projects that we are undertaking this year, this fiscal year, in support of the strategic plan. You all adopt one every 5 years. You'll be doing it next year. And then we have a number of projects we identify each year in support of those strategic priorities. We tell you what they are. You've been hearing about some of them along the way. And at the end of the year, we'll report how we did to make sure that we are operationalizing the strategic plan that you all want us to do. One of those projects is my point number three, which is the lawyer referral service. We explained in the beginning of the year that we have been undertaking a research project to see whether or not we should be providing both to our members and the community a larger lawyer referral service. Every other every other state bar in the country does this. After much research and work, we explained a little bit about what we were doing before. We launched an RFP for a technology solution that will enable us to start that process. We have the responses from the RFP. We hope to finalize a selection in the next several days. And then the idea is that it would be implemented in time for lawyers to sign up during the license renewal process, because that's the best time to get their attention, and then followed thereafter in the coming months with an actual the profile building and the matching service that will then occur. But the idea is, you know, at the end of this fiscal year, beginning of the next fiscal year, we should have a pilot project underway.
Great.
Okay.
2 minutes. How about that?
Good, good, good. Okay. Well, now we're going to turn our attention to the consent agenda. And there are a couple items on this consent agenda. The secretary's report, Roger, thanks again for your work as secretary. Draft minutes from the October 31, 2023 meeting. Proposed revisions to the community's policies and procedures and appointments to the nominations committee.
I would like to move the discussion of the nominations committee members to executive session.
Okay.
Off the consent agenda.
Okay. Do I need a?
You do a motion, or you do it by consensus either way.
Okay. Anyone in disagreement with that? We're going to move that in. Okay. We're going to move that over to the executive session. But for the other matters, we'll just move forward with consent unless there's any objection. Okay, those have been done. And now we will move to the appointment of the DC Bar delegate to the ABA. And I think this has been discussed. We've heard it. Well, can I interrupt? Yes.
So if you could get a motion
to approve
the remaining items on the
consent. Okay. So second? Second, it's been moved and seconded that we approve the remaining items on the consent agenda, the secretary's report, and the proposed revision to the community's policies and procedures. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Okay. Very good.
Thank you. Yeah.
And now we'll move
to
the ABA. And I'll turn it to Aram to...
Sure. There's a memo. I'm happy to answer any questions. In the interest of time, I won't repeat what you have in your materials. We have a vacancy because someone will be resigning effective in 2 weeks. And because the bylaws didn't spell out exactly the process, we kind of cobbled one together. The executive committee has made its recommendation to the board, and we will be updating our bylaws so that there is a specific and explicit explanation of how vacancies for the ABA delegate will be filled in the future. I'm happy to answer any questions that people have.
So just to kind of summarize, so the recommendation is that we take the second highest vote getter in the election.
Yeah.
And that person is?
Alejandro Guadarrama. He is a partner at Skadden. He remains interested in serving in that capacity. And so it's just the board kind of going about its business on his appointment.
I move that we approve appointing Alejandro as our ABA delegate.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded that we approve the appointment of Alejandro to the to take the place or opening on the DC Bar delegate to the ABA. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Okay. So we'll now, I think we'll move to executive session and to discuss the matter of the appointments to the nominations committee. And I believe that's...
There is a general counsel's report as well, but there's nothing super urgent in there. So we, depending on how time goes,
right,
we can always put that off to the next meeting.
Okay. Okay.
Do the consent agenda to approve the minutes, and then if folks want to talk
about it. Okay, let me, oh, yeah, the consent agenda. Okay, so I will now call the meeting to order of the DC Bar Board of Governors executive session.